Today's interview and interview subjects will inspire you to be more creative about how you're creative, and I am 100% certain of that. In this episode of the No Film School podcast, I speak with Frank Oz, who on his own is a legendary figure, and Derek Delgadio, who wrote and created and performed In and of Itself, which Frank directs. Having the two of them on the show is amazing. They have so much insight into the creative process. I intentionally avoid diving too deep into what happens in the course of In and of Itself, because that would rob so many of you of the experience of seeing it. So you can listen to this interview and really go into that still without having a sense of what you're going to see, what you're going to experience. And we wanted to do that on purpose, because you should, if you haven't, go see In and of Itself after this, before this, it doesn't really matter. But I didn't want this interview to alter anyone's experience of that. Speaking to Frank Oz about his experience as a storyteller, a filmmaker, a creator is fascinating. He is one of the most influential creative voices of the last half century. The impact of things like The Muppets, Sesame Street, to say nothing of Yoda, the many films he directed, the works he did with Jim Henson, the kinds of movies he's made, which continually, as he says, break things. His version of storytelling anarchy, creative anarchy, it's inspiring, funny, hopeful. It's the reason to do this stuff. And then to add in Derek, who is such a singular talent, I don't know how to describe what he does or how he does it. You have to see it to believe it. His creation of In and of Itself is singular, unique, and unbelievable, moving. His talent is immense. And the spirit with which they both approach this all is worth mimicking, learning about, understanding, all those things. I hope in this interview we give you a little insight, in as much insight as we could, and I get out of the way as much as I could to let these two genius talents, and I really mean that, connect with you about their work and how they approach it. It would be reductive to refer to what Derek does as magic, although that word seems so appropriate when talking about Derek and Frank, because be it Yoda or Cookie Monster or In-N-Out, the movie, or any of the other great movies that Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which we talk about a lot in this interview that Frank's directed, or In and of Itself and all the things Derek does in it, I don't know what else to say about it besides for that it is magic. I guess first, I just want to, for all of our listeners, can you take us through, each of you at a time, the nature of the collaboration and where it began, what the genesis of it was about this project?
Boy, Derek, do you want to take it? Or?
Sure. Nope. Go ahead, Frank.
I like that.
Frank and I met through kind of a mutual friend when I was doing a show in New York. A mutual friend of ours suggested that Frank come see a show that I was doing, and Frank did. And after the show, he didn't want to say hi to me, but his wife made him. And so we struck up a conversation, and then we had drinks, and then we had some more dinners together, and then we struck up a friendship. And I lived in LA at the time; he lived in New York. And anytime he'd come out to visit his family or work or something like that in LA, we'd sit down and hang out. And it continued like that for a couple of years. And when this idea for the show came around, I knew I needed someone to help with it. But the only person I could think of was Frank. I asked him, and he didn't agree to it right away. But I flew out to New York and kind of pitched a loose skeleton of an idea of what I thought this show could be about. And after, after pitching it, he thought he had something to contribute. So we just started down the path together, and And that was 6 years ago now. So
wow. Was it really?
Yeah.
Holy cow. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we just continued really with that skeleton, which is all the stuff that all the ideas that they're all Derek's. And I was just helping to kind of what, Derek, kind of shape it and give it a shape for theater and also trying to keep you honest, right?
Yeah, and to bring it to life. I mean, I had fragmented ideas that could be pieced together and stitched together to make a breathing, you know, a thing that felt alive. But it certainly wasn't when I approached Frank with it. And he saw that it might be possible if I was willing to put in the work. And I was.
Yeah, he sure was.
I'm curious. So what was the first, you mentioned the first sort of instance was Frank, you were attending a show that Derek was doing. And then afterwards what was that project? What was the show?
It was similar in the sense that it was a sleight of hand show but it wasn't anything like this.
Yeah. It was no similarity other than once in this show is sleight of hand, but he was wonderful. What impressed me most about him was how non-performative he was. He wasn't trying to sell anything. He was just talking. And that was a huge, huge thing for me. And then my wife said, "You want to meet him?" I said, "Nah, I don't, you know, I get shy." And so then she forced me to, and then we got friendly.
That's very cool. So now I want to go a little bit back, if that's okay. And Derek, I'll start with you.
Mm-hmm.
If you can give me a little bit of your, you know, the story of how you became in the arts, in performance, and then in sleight of hand, like how all of this sort of evolved, and maybe what the inspiration points were. I know you had something that you had some time with the Walt Disney Imagineering. Yeah. There's some work on things like The Prestige, but I kind of want to, if you can help us piece it together, but also tell us where it began for you as an artist.
It's scattered, certainly.
that's okay.
Yeah. I grew up, I had a untraditional background in terms of, born to a teenage mother, didn't have a dad around and stuff. So we struggled together as a team, kind of growing up together, my mother and I. And, got into storytelling, was really interested in film and interesting types of things to choose when you're like 10 years old. I was like really interested in Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. And I listened to a lot of comedy albums and things like that.
Which ones were the formative ones?
I love Bill Hicks. I was really big into Bill Hicks starting when I was like 12 years old. But I liked, Carlin, Lenny Bruce, Chris Rock had just made Bigger and Blacker, something like that, which I thought was amazing. Yeah. Was storytellers, you know. Steve Martin was a massive fan of Steve Martin's. I loved everything he did. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels was top three movies, you know, for me at that time. I think it was the first DVD I ever bought was Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Mm. Oh, cool. So there's a connection here then.
Yeah.
we'll get to that later.
Yeah. So I was interested in performing things, and teachers were always telling my mother they should get me into performing arts school. We couldn't afford to do that. And so that always just sounded nice when people said it. And she was going through a rough separation from her partner, and she played a practical joke on me. It was where a can exploded. Like you put a firecracker under a Coke can, basically, and it explodes when you lift it up. And she did this basically like, you know, lighten the mood in the house because it was pretty tense. And I thought it was hilarious and wanted to know where she got it. And she told me that there was a joke shop by her work. And so we eventually went, and she had a coffee while I went in and explored. And it turns out it wasn't a joke shop. It was a magic shop, or at least that's what they claimed they were. And I saw the guy made a little pocket knife vanish, and it was just amazing to me. And so I bought a book on sleight of hand that day. I was 12 years old, and I just kind of became obsessed with the idea of being able to reveal and conceal things at will, to make things vanish and reappear and transform. And I never performed it for anyone, which is kind of the curious thing about my relationship with sleight of hand. is I was never interested in doing it for anyone. It was like, my mother was like, is like pulling teeth. She's like, she was a firefighter. She said, oh, wow. She would like, I would visit her at the firehouse and she would tell me to do something for her coworkers. And I would refuse. I'd be like, no, that's all right. And she'd be like, we save people's lives for a living. The least you could do is a card trick. And so she'd guilt me into doing something for them. But yeah, so I had this on the one hand, I had an interest in performing and humor and writing. And on the other hand, I had this skill set of sleight of hand that was separate from the performance aspect of it. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s that I started trying to merge the two. And I didn't find any joy in it, really. I didn't like performing those two things together. I didn't like demonstrating sleight of hand or performing illusions. It wasn't really interesting to me. And so I stopped that, and I became interested in performance art and conceptual art, and I studied that for 5 years or so, and then informally with an artist named Glenn Kino, and then started kind of integrating all of these things that I picked up over the years into one practice that I could call my own, and that's sort of where Frank comes into the picture, I guess.
Yeah, you mentioned this through line that connects to what Frank said initially when he first saw you, and I want to hear Frank elaborate on it, that there's this unwillingness or disinterest to perform these things, which is fascinating. Like, it's almost like in and of itself a sleight of hand, kind of, right? Well, in and of itself, there you go.
Sure.
But like, there's something sort of like, isn't that, I mean, what is, how does that manifest? And can you tell me more about how you were drawn to that, Frank? That particular.
Yeah, it was not that he didn't want to perform. That wasn't, most people on stage will attempt to get the audience's reaction and perform in such a way that they do. Derek does not. If you want to hear Derek, you just got to listen. You got to lean in. And we wanted Derek and I both wanted the audience to understand that, Derek would do the show by himself. It was for them. So he wasn't trying to sell in any way. He was just telling his story. And that was huge because there was no real emphasis on words, on and emotions. He was just flat out talking. And that's rare. So that was really what impressed me.
And of course, like going back to some of your, you are a, cinema legend, you're a legend in many ways, but the idea of performing, creating an illusion sort of ties into some of your origins, I would imagine, in puppeteering and things like that. Is that why this is something you're drawn to personally?
No, I couldn't care less about magic.
Okay. The connection isn't there. It's just me connecting dots that don't.
Yeah, as I told Derek, I mean, I do not want to direct a magic show, and thank God Derek didn't either. I see no joy in having a trick, blackout, applause, trick, blackout, applause. Fortunately, Derek and I are the same mind that we're both, I don't think necessarily rebellious or anarchic, but we're certainly in that direction that we're trying to, as we say, break things. So it was very fortuitous that he asked me to, because even before that, I didn't know really he wanted to go in that direction. And I love that direction.
I mean, Frank is obviously very humble, but I think part of it is I think he would never say that what he's done with his own former craft of puppeteering or craft, I don't know if he's still considered, but the craft of puppeteering, in that it's transcendent. Like, Frank doesn't do puppets; he brings things to life, it's so far beyond puppeteering that it's in its own league. It's transcendent. And
I think Derek and I are very similar in that we both know that behind what he does and behind what I do is years and years of work.
Yeah.
And years and years of training. And we have a problem with people calling Derek a magician when it's really a skill. And we have a problem with calling me a puppeteer because it's always associated with, puppets are cute and they're for children. And magicians just, pull doves out of their coats. That kind of perception, when really, as Derek says, we're both looking for transcendency, you know, in our work.
Yeah, it's funny because even as I mean, I referred to what you have done as puppeteering, and I thought, God, it feels like that is not the right word, just because it's like it's bigger than it that. Is. Like it feels like it's like, and I didn't know what to call it. But I think I want to know more about this idea of the years of work, because obviously pulling off, breathing life into the characters, the creations you have, Frank, but also these kinds of sleight of hand illusions. The thing that fascinates me about the "I would do it if I was alone and there was no audience" is that that is so much training and practice. Is that the joy on its own?
Well, I'll answer that from my part as a director. For me, the joy is that, yes, because he doesn't need an audience. The character in that movie and on stage is working on something and struggling something inside that you're not aware of. You're not aware of the real story underneath that, but you can sense the struggle. And so he would have to struggle to figure this thing out, whether there was an audience there or not.
That kind of also goes back to what you said about that you have to lean in.
Yeah. And the biggest joy, I've heard this before, but I would see the show for about a year and a half now, every week for sure. And the biggest joy I had, I always sat in the back. Not one person coughed. They didn't move. It's one of those things you pray for. It was extraordinary.
I've known people who saw it live and they rave about it, the experience.
And one of the reasons, again, the major reason is that Derek is not acting. Derek is it's exhausting what Derek did. He waited and wouldn't say anything until he felt like saying something. And I told him, you can stand there for 30 seconds or a minute. I don't care. But don't talk until you feel like talking. And I think the audience can sense that honesty.
So it's truly a unique craft that you sort of put together with this. It's not, it doesn't really fall neatly into a category, right?
No.
Is that part of the design, the intent, or can you guys tell me a little bit about that?
Well, we felt like if you were able to describe it, we'd failed. In the sense that, I mean, yeah, if we're talking about magical creatures that exist in this world that defy definitions, then if we didn't do that, we failed, you know, and we've just made another theater show or another show or a one man show or a magic show or whatever anyone wanted to call it, or me, or what they had seen. If they were able to easily label it, we felt like we didn't do our job, because it is a show about defying labels, you know?
Yeah, which is why it's called In and of Itself. One cannot define it.
Yeah, I like that. Frank, you mentioned like this desire to break things. This feels like certainly it's a departure from normal formats or expressions or storytelling, and so it falls right in line in that. Is that something that you've done at other points, or that's been a through line for you personally? Or is it something you constantly seek out, or you're just seeking out now?
It really was serendipitous. You know, all my professional life, I've done huge movies, you know, 40, 50, 80, $100 million movies. And I didn't try to get them. I just didn't screw up, and they kept on asking me, you know? And so every time they asked me, I said, yeah, because this particular script I loved, or the people I was working with. But underneath it, my heart was more rebellious than that. And by meeting Derek, and that's the rebelliousness and the kind of affectionate, what I call anarchy of the Muppets, when the four of us were starting in 1963, just a ragtag group. And that was what I loved. And all of a sudden I got successful. But when I get work with Derek, I can go back to that feeling, you know?
That is so cool. Just as a fan of all these things, that is just so cool to hear. Now that you say that, I'm looking back at the history even of the Muppets, and I'm thinking, oh, maybe they were constantly trying to break something. Like, it seems like the format kept jumping, or the limits kept getting pushed. Is that correct?
Jim always did that. You know, I mean, that's the trouble. People wanted Bert and Ernie all the time, and he wanted to try Dark Crystal and other things.
Right, yeah. And that, so at a certain point, you know, you launched from there into doing these you know, bigger movies and bigger movies and just saying yes because they were exciting for some reason. But so this is a return in some way for you to something that feels closer to just the four guys being anarchists.
So the four guys and to my heart.
Yeah, that's amazing. Especially now, you know, things are so we're so inundated with the familiar, with the nostalgic, like the things we've seen before, the way we've seen them before. And it seems like there's like this constant craze to get that. We're starving for somebody to break things and be an anarchist in this medium, in these mediums. Tell me about doing that on stage versus doing that in the movie for both of you. I want to hear, I'm really curious to know, like, cause you know, no film school where, you know, film is the thing. If this was just on stage, we probably would unfortunately not be having the conversation, but I want to know how you did it in the stage and then how it all moved over.
Well,
or how it changed or didn't.
Well, they're the same process, but different mediums in that we knew what we wanted to achieve, but we didn't, we reminded ourselves that we didn't know how to do it in a positive way. One of the things that Frank is really good at is not knowing things, which sounds like it's true though. He's very, very good at seeing things for the first time, which is actually a skill set to be able to wash away all that preconceived notions, all those preconceived notions or all the, what you think you know about a thing. With the show, we were very much staring into an abyss at all times because I was refusing to let it be anything that resembled anything else. Oh, to a frustrating point, like telling, like, you know, Frank and I, we never really argued ever, but we had deep conversations about things that were frustrating because, like, I would say, I don't, like the language of, I would say, I don't want to act. And Frank would be like, I don't want you to act. If I catch you acting, I'll kill you. And like creating a language between us of understanding what the other person means when they say a specific word and like kind of using, like we settle on words to kind of define a thing because.
Can you tell me some of them? Well, some of the words that like, I mean, also I have to say, if I catch you acting, I'll kill you is like the best director's note to an actor I've ever heard. So we'll have to.
It's effective.
That one.
It's effective. no, well, just like in that particular example, I because there's so much artifice related to what I, at least the perception of what I was doing, because people had known me for doing magic and sleight of hand and these things. They, a lot of people knew me as a magician. I knew that everything needs to be honest, almost to a fault. Like everything else needs to be so honest to make up for any sort of perception of deception that might be happening in the spectator's mind, which actually made it really difficult for Frank to do his job sometimes because we wanted to make it something that they could go on a journey with us. But like, I knew that I had done these lines before, that I said them the night before, or that I was going to repeat them over and over again. And so it's very challenging to create any sort of
spontaneity,
anything that doesn't sound like a directive of use your acting, you know, without saying, because he never did say that. But in my brain, because we hadn't worked together before, we're in unknown territory. So to kind of be able to create a dialogue between us that I'm able to explore a thing over and over again without feeling like I've been there before was part of the process. Does that make sense? Because I knew I was going to do the show over and over again.
I have a couple follow-ups and I don't know if they all have answers. One is for Frank, I'm curious if you can put it into words or explain it. How do you come at things with fresh eyes the way that Derek describes? Is it something you have an awareness of? Is it something you have to maintain?
I'm very aware. As a matter of fact, I was in there's a comedy festival up north and they wanted me to do a speech on comedy. And I don't believe you can. And my speech was about the fact that I don't know comedy. And I mean that because if one knows, one can't discover. So in regards to this show, I put myself in the position of absolutely not knowing a thing and knowing that I'm on a cliff and I could fall or I could stand up and live. I'm just going to react to everything I see without my head. I'm just going to react. And that's what happened.
Yeah. And let me just say, as the performer, as the person who is looking to his director, and he's the one who's just like unhooked his safety harness. It's a little disconcerting in the creative process.
I was gonna say, I can imagine.
Because I feel like I'm staring into an abyss and I have to go out there and do this thing on the high wire or whatever. And he's basically going like, yep, you're gonna do it. you're not gonna do it. Because he's not one to comfort me in that regard, because you can't be comforted, especially not with something like this. You have to know that what you're doing is scary, and that means we're at least doing something.
Yeah, and I the biggest question I had was, in the when I met him, and I had to answer that before I said yes, was, will he go the distance? And I thought he would, and he did. And that's a lot. Derek put so much into this because he wasn't remembering lines. Every performance was more visceral, and he had to trust that the rest of the words would come. So it was a huge thing for anybody to do. As a matter of fact, there were some very well-known actors. Remember Derek and friends of mine?
Yep.
And said, I learned something from Derek, you know?
Streamlining the post-production video editing process just got a whole lot easier with Spider Checker Video. It's a handy, portable tool designed to leverage how video is processed when working with vector scopes, waveform monitors, and editing software. Included is a patent-pending color pattern card that generates an easy-to-understand pattern of hues at 2 saturation levels, so you can see how all colors between primary and secondary colors are being captured. The result? You start off with more accurate color at the start of your video shoots, so you have less color editing to do later. Now you can save $20 off the purchase price of Datacolor Spider Checker Video. Just visit datacolor.com/NFS and enter code NFS at checkout. Offer is valid in US and Canada through 6/30/24.
The thing I keep thinking that I'm thinking now is this feeling as a director or as a creator that you approached with this project of, I'm going to stand on the edge of the cliff. I don't know if I'll fall or if I'll be standing. Did you do that when you showed up, like day one of shooting on some of these massive movies you've done?
No.
Okay. So this was a different, I was going to say, is that like how you go through life?
But also yes. You know, if it's a $50 million or $80 million movie, I am totally and completely prepared. Totally. Because people ask you dozens of questions every day. I have to be completely and totally prepared. And I am prepared in order to forget the preparation and just experience it.
It's,
yeah,
actually,
I see.
Not to call you on this, Frank, but you do actually do it on movies, because I know for a fact that you and Steve Martin, like, throughout every page of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels as they came and kind of rewrote things on the fly. And
we did.
And that is the same. That's the same thing of like, of finding it, the courage to find it in the moment and trust that maybe what was written isn't right for this live moment that we're experiencing right now.
Yeah. For instance, I'm sorry to bring myself into this. I'll make this short. When I did The Plant, you know, The Little Shop of Horrors, it was like, you know, huge budget. I have no idea how I was going to do The Plant. So we just went forward, you know? With Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, the ending was terrible. Steve and I reworked the ending over months, but while we were shooting. So it's scary, but boy, is it exciting.
That sounds like a little bit. I mean, one thing I'm thinking of again is like, if you have prepped for years, you mentioned earlier, the hours, the years of practice that go into knowing how to create the living Yoda or Fozzie or whoever it is,
the skills of sleight of hand, right?
Right, exactly. That all that practice, all that prep is what allows you to be natural, what allows you to let anything happen and survive.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you're like these finely tuned athletes, like, because they've rehearsed everything a million times, but they can have no idea what's going to happen in the moment.
The way I look at it is that, and I believe this is for Derek too, but I don't want to speak for him, that all my years of working and doing hundreds and hundreds of shows, I now have a very big toolbox. I got screwdrivers, I got pliers, I got hammers, I got the right size nails. I know that toolbox is there, which means I can just wing it and know that if I'm in trouble, I just reach for that hammer.
Yeah. Scary, though, for those of you out there who don't have the toolbox yet, be careful about winging it.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, that's
but because a lot of practice went into you having that, you know, having that ability to say, I can make, like, I mean, I love what you said about comedy, and I'm sure it works with sleight of hand, too, is like things may change in the moment. And if you're not, if you're not free to experience or explore, I mean, that's what improvisation is. But
yeah,
you have to be trained enough, right, to be ready for that.
Yeah. My dad used to say, he was a sign painter. He said, before any words were written, the teacher told him, draw a square and draw a circle. You know, just the basics.
Yeah.
You know, I gotta say one thing about, if you don't mind, Derek, we're talking a lot about the sleight of hand, but, you know, this is not the show. And as far as I'm concerned, Derek knows this, I've always seen this as a transition show for Derek. So the next show he does may not have any magic at all.
Correct.
His mind works in such a way that he can create something that's new without necessarily having to do that. But what the show is really strong in is not the magic or illusions. It's Derek's ideas.
Right. And I gather that, or I see it, because you can do those things without, like, the humanity, the soul, the personal experience that's bringing to it that makes it unique, a unique experience unlike others. Those things don't necessarily drive it. Sort of like a plot
right.
is to character, right?
Sure.
And this is an unusual show because actually this is Derek's life.
Yeah, I'm curious because Frank's teed it up, Derek. Do you see or have you considered or started to see like what's next or where you evolve from here?
I think if the show did anything for me, it's liberated me from any notion that I need to adhere to any particular form. It's all the same. Making things is the same. It's just a matter of what medium you're working in or what materials you're working with or how you're presenting what you're presenting. But I feel liberated is all I can say, is that I don't feel like I need to adhere to any particular form or style or anything, really. I feel like I just let whatever is bubbling up inside of me, I trust that and move that direction.
I keep thinking about how I read about, you know, Orson Welles making Citizen Kane and how he had this, why don't we do this? Because he didn't know what couldn't be done yet. So he experimented, essentially. So he had beginner's eyes and experience, and it allowed a freedom and it allowed an breaking of things and an anarchy that became something that was a new mold, essentially. Yeah. But still,
and
unique.
And he had youth, 25 years old.
Yeah. Yes, very much so. And that allowed that, I think, a little bit, but you don't, how do you hold on to that? I mean, that, it sounds like, Derek, you're there, you feel liberated in that space now. And Frank, if it sounds like you've sought it out, you know, intentionally, especially on this project, but that is a challenging thing to stick to.
I think one has to protect one's purity. And I do it with my characters. They come from a pure place. And Derek's work comes from a pure place. I think we have to be very protective of that.
I think that the film, how it manifested, is also an example of that, because it was different in the sense that we created the show from nothing. It was just literally ideas on a page that were then had to be manifested into the real world somehow.
Can you share with us some of those first ideas on that page from the very beginning?
They were the same.
What's that?
They were the same, Derek.
Yeah, they were. They were
only one thing we didn't use.
Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty much the show that assuming the listeners have seen it at this point, or are we just assuming they haven't?
Well, we can just, let's, I mean, it doesn't, not matter, give anything away, I guess.
It doesn't matter. Like, what you see in the film and what manifested on stage was what I pitched to Frank, basically, in his living room. Now, how that looked like, how that came about, but the ideas were all there. I knew I was going to ask someone to leave and come back the next day. I knew that I was going to, you know, there would be a moment with a letter and how I saw a person transforming in front of our eyes. And I, these ideas about identity and the Ruletista. These were all on paper and told to Frank in his living room, but it was all just ideas. And so that's the easy part in the sense of like dreaming. It's hard to do, but comparatively to actually realizing those dreams is difficult. And so that was the first boulder up the hill. And then with the film, we had the material in the sense that we knew, unlike the first time when we created the show, we knew what we had to work with. The question is, how do we translate it to this new medium? How do we get it to work on film in a way that will be as effective, question mark, or have a different effect? Like what can we say in this medium that we couldn't have said in the live experience? And that was a big question and one that was kind of scary because Frank knows film really well. And I have been a fan of film and know how hard it is to make a live performance translate to film. And it's not easy. Like there's not a lot of great performance films, you know, out there. There's a handful of that rise above, and the rest are all just kind of like, yep, that must have been good to see live.
Can you tell me about like any hesitancy, or was there a, yeah, I don't want to do this kind of moment. I don't think we should do it. We should transfer it. And, or then also like as a follow-up, how did you change it to emphasize the other medium?
It was never like a certainty that it would be something that would work.
No, but this was Derek's idea to make a movie, and he never faltered. He never faltered on that.
So it was always there in your mind that you were going to try to move it into the movie, the film medium.
It was there when it was there. It wasn't there, and then it was there. In terms of, I've never made a habit of filming my work because it's just pointless. I felt it just let the live stuff be the live stuff. And if you want to go make a movie, go make a movie. I feel that way about a lot of different things where I see people doing like dipping their toe into an area when it's like, just do the thing. If you want to do the thing, do the thing. But don't, you know, sacrificing another thing for that. So I felt that like, I've always felt that way about my work, that it should remain its own thing. And then if I want to make a film, I'll make a film. But with this, I saw something else. I saw there was a possibility that it could maybe work. It could maybe be translated. And once Frank saw the footage, I think he agreed. You agreed, right, Frank?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. It'd be a funny time to find out he didn't.
Yeah,
I agreed. But like you, we didn't know how to do it. And it's interesting. Derek and I are interesting in that I think I'm not as good alone without Derek on these ideas that for him. And he's not as good without me. Somehow we feed each other because we're in the same plane and we get it.
Yeah, we definitely feed off each other.
You know, taking it to film and having made tons of movies, this isn't sort of like in the same line, but for you, Frank, like, how do you forget all the ways you've made movies normally to say like, this is not going to be like that. Like I'm unlearning all my ways of doing it. Like I'm not going to think about the ways I do things when I approach every other movie I've done. Or did you?
Well, the movies I've done, except for a documentary, I've done a dozen features and they're all scripted. Although they're not finished, we continue changing the script as I shoot. This was not scripted. This was a workshop session that, you know, this is Derek's show, and I was trying to help Derek create his show into something transcendent along with him. And so you can't really compare the two.
Yeah. Right. It's
you came at it. Yeah. Yeah. It was like a brand new thing, complete from the ground up. Yeah.
And I think that's the thing. That it's important to unlearn a lot of stuff in order to get to the position where you don't know anything.
But it's also a hybrid in the sense that it's not scripted in that you can't shoot the script, but the story's there. The script is there. So it's not documentary. Yeah. It's not documentary in the sense that you're capturing real life, because we do know the next line that's going to be said on stage by me, at least, you know? So there is a script in that regard, but it's very difficult to, it's a hybrid, it's in between. It's real life in a theatrical context. And so we had to let it tell us what it needed to be, really.
And if you could explain it right now, then you would have failed, right? Like as you said earlier, this inability to explain precisely what it is you were trying to film is exactly by design.
Yeah,
I mean, it's an invigorating thing, I have to say. The approach and the fidelity to this ideal of what you were attempting to accomplish and the value of that, the protecting of that perspective, it's inspiring in a time when I feel like a lot of things fall into a very familiar buckets, you know?
Well, that's good to hear. To answer your question about the film, or at least to wrap up that idea, is that like we learned some things that we couldn't have predicted or anticipated in the process of editing and making it, in that, like, for instance, we didn't know that my performance on stage would be as effective on film, because generally speaking, if you film a show in a theater, the acting that you'll see on screen at home or whatever is theatrical. And when we first started watching the footage of me, it wasn't theatrical at all. It was pretty raw, to the point of being like exposed and kind of like, Jesus, this is very raw, you know? And that was, yeah. That was, in hindsight, it shouldn't have been a surprise, but again, the context of these things deceive you. Like you think that it's going to look like another performance film because you're in a theater and there's stage lights and all that stuff. But then if you actually take the risk of doing it, of going down the road of, well, let's see what this looks like. Let's try it. Why not? As opposed to just going, we can never do it because it's never been done before.
Might throw out there, like, instead of also saying we have to change it so much because otherwise it'll never work, because we know exactly how those things always turn out. So you let it happen and responded in the moment. I thought that too. There's a, you know, for me, my mental picture, whenever I think about, oh, it's a performance, it's a live performance that's been recorded or put to film, I always kind of think of those, like, you know, the VHS recordings of performances that you used to come across, because it was like often all you could get or all that there was, which is completely out of step with what it would be today. But we do have these assumptions about medium or about the way something's going to turn out. So you both had to turn that off and try it, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll say something about that, what Derek was talking about. Remember I said that Derek, what struck me most in the first show I saw him in was his non-performative speaking?
Yeah. Well,
from that moment on to now, 6 years later, it's that very thing that makes him really good on film too. Because what you want to do on film is not to do too much and allow the audience not only in the theater to come to you, but the audience in a movie to come to you. And if you're doing too much, they're just going to sit back and wait for you to give them stuff. But if you're going to be, if you want them to lean forward, the way Derek gives information in storytelling, that's what happens.
That's such a great point. And it makes me think, how did that manifest for you when you're doing a character, to not do too much, because you're trying to get, you know, I can only imagine that there's an tendency or an instinct that you have to do a lot to get something that maybe can't do the slightest twitch of an eye or the smallest, you know. How did you get us to lean in when you do things like that? And that's something that's magic to me.
Same thing with Derek. It was years and years of working to try and make it happen. It's just years and years and years and years of doing it.
No one wants to hear that answer, Frank.
Yeah, I know.
It's true. That's not the answer people want.
It's the truth. And then once you have that toolbox, as I said, repeating that, then you realize you don't have to do that much, because if you really want to do more, you can just grab a hammer.
I mean, I'm also just thinking about, you know, things like Standing on the Cliff, like you said, like now a lot of your projects make sense in that context, Dark Crystal or performing Yoda. These were things that at the time would have seemed like, I don't know about that. Like, I don't know if that's going to work. Like,
but isn't that the joy?
That is, yeah, that's the magic.
That's the joy of it. Who wants to be safe?
When you describe that quality in Derek this last time when you spoke about it, that he makes you lean in, it reminded me of, I've never really been able to accurately explain what it is about a Marlon Brando performance that I acknowledge is like, yeah, there is something good in a way that I can't identify. And as you were describing that, I thought, I think it's that I'm always wondering what he's going to do, kind of.
Right.
Like, I'm not entirely confident. And I remembered you've directed him. So yeah. I'm wondering if that was an experience, you know, in that, was that part of what he's doing on set? There's an unpredictability, or just there's a nature to him? Is that part of what you mean when you're talking about when Derek's doing this show?
It's not quite the same. Marlon was unpredictable and extraordinary, but it's not that Derek is unpredictable.
Right.
He he's not predictable either. But right. what he is he's absolutely being absolutely true to the moment. And yeah. That is what connects with people.
Yeah. And that's I don't want to put you in a spot, Derek, where I'm telling you in the world, like, hey, this guy's like Marlon Brando. Like, I'm not trying to, but there is, I'm recognizing that what it is that I'm really curious what's going to come next. Cause I'm not entirely confident that I know. I can't quite see what's in front of what's going to happen.
I think part of it is having the courage to not know yourself. Like me, like the truth is we don't know. Even in the context of a stage performance where the same thing is said over and over again, the real truth is you don't know what's going to happen next. Because and I learned that through doing, because I would maybe think I would know what's going to happen, and then sure enough, someone in the audience has a stroke and we have to wait 15 minutes. I'm not kidding. Like, this stuff happened. Like, wait 15 minutes for an ambulance to come in, and then the stretcher, and then they load the guy up and take him off, and then I have to continue again. Now, I thought I knew what was coming next, but I didn't. And like, life has a way of humbling you. And so I think if you can, even if you know what's coming next, if you can maintain some of that humility that you actually don't, even though you think you do, then that uncertainty is life, you know?
I think there's such a vast philosophical underpinning to what you're saying there, which is that we are surrounded by, we fool ourselves by thinking there's some daily stability or moment to moment stability, that we absolutely know what's going to happen at each time of every day in any schedule. And it's all so fragile and completely unpredictable and chaotic. Right. And or ordered by however you view the universe. But that spirit, maybe the honesty of that approach is what's resonant.
I think it's because we're not thinking too much. In my opinion, if more writers and directors and actors cut off their heads when they work, they'd be in much better shape. I mean, when the brain gets involved, the work usually gets worse.
Yes, and we're definitely going in a cerebral direction as we discuss it. But I'll go back to my metaphor with an athlete, which is that they're so trained that they can stop thinking when they do.
That's right.
Which is, I assume some of both of your training, the hours and hours of training allows you to just like, oh, Yoda's just living in the moment now because I know all the things. Like, I don't have to worry about the rehearsal. You know, I'm living in the moment, reacting.
You're right. But one of the things that's really, and Frank talked about going the distance. He recognized that I could maybe go the distance. I didn't know what that meant until I did it. He told me that, and I still didn't know what it meant until after. Because like at some point during the run, I think I asked him, like, why did you agree to do this? You know, and he said, I recognized that you wanted to break something, and I wanted to help you do it. And I thought you'd go the distance. And the first time he even told me that, I didn't really understand it because I hadn't done it. Really, I maybe thought I was like, yeah, I can go the distance. I've seen Rocky. I know you got to train. You know, like,
I mean, my assumption is just like you'd show up every day until you were done. I really have to thank you both for taking so much time to do this. It's been incredible.
Sure.
But I will wrap up soon, I promise. I'm really fascinated. Can you each tell me what go the distance means to you and meant in the context? Maybe Derek, you can tell me what it meant the first time was the Rocky thing. What did it mean in the end?
I mean, it's the irony is that you got to go the distance to end up right where you are, just like any good story, right? You end up where you're back at the beginning. But like, it's depth. Really, I was thinking about, and I knew it was obviously an analogy, but man, we all have something, we all have our inner lives, and that we're walking around with these worlds inside of us. And every once in a while, we're able to pick something up outside of ourselves to show others something that we recognize as a fundamental truth within ourselves that also exists within someone else. And sometimes that can just be something simple and, like a joke that makes someone laugh and we all have a shared experience. But other times it's more complex and the ideas are more nuanced, or it's an avenue of humanity or something that we haven't really explored yet. And I didn't realize what it takes to actually mine that and to actually dig out a piece of yourself to show the world so that they can see themselves. And Frank has done that over the years through so many different parts of himself that he understands what it takes to do the distance. Part of that is discipline. Part of that is just necessity of, he has a job and has to show up and do a good job and wants to do a good job. But he's both the right person in the right place at the right time to have gone the distance in several different ways. So he knows what that means. And I had done it personally for myself in terms of my craft, in terms of being a student of really wanting to be the best at something and working hard to achieve the things that are physically necessary to do that. But I didn't know what it meant in terms of the context of otherness and what it meant to go the distance when it comes to now what? Now that you have these things that you've picked up, how are you going to show people? And sometimes the distance you need to travel or the depth you need to go to mine whatever it is you're trying to show them is really difficult. And you can do it at a surface level, which is fine, or you can really dig deep and you can try to find something that no one has ever seen before and come back. But that's a really tough, it's like going to Mordor, you know, you gotta make the journey. And so for me, that's, I don't know if that answers the question, but that's what it felt like.
Yeah. I'll give you a spelunking answer. You know spelunking?
Yes. No, I do. Yes.
Spelunking is exploring caves and such.
Yes.
So you go in you go in there and holy cow, this is gorgeous. Look at all the stalagmites. My God. And there's a light coming from a hole in there, and I can see the sun. That's fantastic. Now, you could settle with that. And all of a sudden, wait a second, there's this other place, this hole over there. Well, maybe there's something over there. Let's go to that hole. And that is narrower and a little more difficult to get through. And then you go a little bit further and say, oh, geez, look at that. I've never seen a stalactite like that. That's like an unusual one. And then you found something new. And then all of a sudden you say, wait a second, there's another hole. There's another hole there. And you keep going and you keep going and you start squeezing and you start struggling and you're out of breath. And then you get to the very, very end and there's nothing left. And there's extraordinary diamond there. That's going the distance to me.
There's a scene in the movie Gattaca. Or no, Gattaca. Is that Gattaca with Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman and Jude Law? There's a wonderful scene in that movie where they're swimming and Ethan Hawke is posing as a perfect being. And he has to like pretend he's better than he is. And they have to swim out past a certain point. He does it with someone who's not as in good a shape as him. And he asks him, how are you doing this? Like, he shouldn't be able to swim like this. How are you doing this? And he says, I didn't save anything for the trip back. And that really is it, is not saving anything, not holding anything back every single time, every single moment. And that's really, really hard to do.
And that is why Derek was exhausted all the time, because that's what it took every night.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. I don't have words. Great answers and beautiful metaphors also, but you're both storytellers, so that follows. But I just, I'll finish though, Frank, how did you know that he could go the distance? Was it a hopeful guess, or did you really feel like because he didn't even understand at the time you said it what you truly meant?
I know this sounds like an easy answer, but how do you know that that woman is going to be your wife? I don't know. I have no idea. All I know is I believed it. I felt it.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's part of the manifesting of it in the world. I don't know, but it's who knows?
Yeah.
Again, I can't thank you both enough.
I want to make something clear here. I was married. I didn't need a wife, just so you know that.
Derek, so Derek's not, he's not on the hook for that.
No. Yeah. Imagine my disappointment.
Thank you guys. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. You know, one of the funny things about this particular interview was, as I said goodbye to Frank and Derek and clicked off the recorder, I walked into the other room and my kids were watching The Muppets. And it just struck me that Frank's impact is so massive that his creations alone, his work, stretches beyond into so many places. And the spirit of what Derek does and his performance, the humanity in it, the attempt to connect with us as individuals on a deeper level or a meaningful level, it comes from such a pure place in the same way that I think that a lot of Frank's work does. And it just hit me particularly hard that there are reasons to create art or film or do whatever it is you do beyond success, beyond accolades, that we don't talk about enough. Do we create these things to change the way people feel about themselves or see one another? Do we try to have a positive impact in some way? I think it gets lost, even when we talk about we want to tell good stories, but that feels almost like it's not a real thing. We want to connect. We want to bring each other up. We want to make each other see ourselves and the world in new ways. And these two guys do that. And I hope all of you do one day as well.